AI, right, to me, augmented intelligence is the basic stuff. Forget about artificial intelligence. First should be augmented intelligence, right? How do you help the people to do things they could not do?
You're listening to Augmented Ops, where manufacturing meets innovation. We highlight the transformative ideas and technologies shaping the front lines of operations, helping you stay ahead of the curve in the rapidly evolving world of industrial tech. Here's your host, Natan Linder, CEO and co-founder of Tulip, the frontline operations platform.
This week on Augmented Ops, we're chatting with Professor Jay Lee from the University of Maryland, where he serves as director of the Industrial Artificial Intelligence Center. While a lot of people love to talk about AI, Professor Lee has spent much of his career actually on the shop floor implementing these tools and putting them to use in scenarios like building cars and many, many more. His career spans industry, government, academia, and it gives him a unique perspective on how we should be approaching this technology and its application. Today, we'll be discussing with him how industrial AI is reshaping manufacturing operations, global supply chains, and how our education system needs to adapt to train the next generation of AI-driven manufacturing practitioners. Let's go. Welcome to Augmented Ops. Today we have with us Professor Jay Lee from the University of Maryland. Jay and I have known each other for quite some time now, a few years. We've met at the governor's meetings of the World Economic Forum, where Tulip was a tech pioneer. And Jay was like our teacher. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Both, we are learning from each other.
Yeah, we were just like preparing for this and I was like, wow, it's like very tough to summarize your very long and impressive career. You've been in academia, teaching, you know, industrial operations. You have served in government bodies, you know, across NSF and of course, World Economic Forum. You build centers and nonprofits, but you also been in industry, in companies like Foxconn and started their industrial artificial intelligence center. How would you summarize your career?
I think everyone's career all depend on destiny and also their purpose, right? Two different things. Some people want to do something. Some people have a different destiny. The people you met, the people you knew might change our destiny sometimes. But I wanted to have a balanced career from day one. So when I was in industry many years ago in the real world manufacturing, the automotive industry and later on in the service industry, you realize you want to do something that can make a big deal. But how do you make a big deal? So you need to understand from top down.
Yeah.
So I had opportunity work for, you know, National Science Foundation. So you can oversee a lot of stuff going on from an academic professor and also from different perspective of different innovation from even from students, right?
Absolutely.
So they give you a good inspiration, you know, what kind of things that academia can bring in. And also then you're back to industry again and to say, I want to do something again, right? And eventually after a few years, I said, no, I got too much idea. You know, you have too many different things going on. You want to do a good deep research. Then you became professor, right? So then you back to industry again to do different things. So like a heat treatment, I sometimes see myself like a heat treatment. You make metal, you quench it and create hardness. Then you do tempering. You make yourself have a good stiffness, right? So so that's the way I see myself. And I do believe in manufacturing is a noble profession. So you cannot just stay in one place and for one set of knowledge and for a lifetime, right? You need to have a good heat treat process, give you enough different type of strength, stiffness, hardness. Eventually, you have a balance of capabilities. That's what I'm saying,
Yeah, it's amazing how you say, you know, manufacturing is a noble profession. It's so it's inspiring because, you know, I always think about winemaking, you know, that fundamentally humanity made wines of all sorts and beers of all sorts like forever in its manufacturing. So much have changed, nothing can change at the same time. Sometimes I think about it through the, we are the homo faber, you know, we're the the technology-wielding mammal, you know.
That's correct.
Manufacturing is such an important facility of that. So we both spend time thinking about like where manufacturing and specifically humans in manufacturing are going towards, especially with the, you know, there's no shortage of technology in manufacturing operations. And maybe before we dive into that and like provocating a little bit, you know, and kind of thinking through your recent published book, you'll tell us all about it in a little bit. But before we do that, let's do a quick exercise. Where did you start your career in production when you were like first production line? Take us there and like, what is your job? What are you doing? What are you making? How does the production line look like?
Well, I start out from machine tool industry, right? In early years, and the NC programmer. Can you believe in 1983, NC programmer, we use a APT language, right? Automatic programming tool, we call APT. Then you punch a tape.
Yeah.
The tape, then you bring to the post-processor machine.
No G-code? No G-code? No.
You load it to the machine based on different type of configuration. You could like a Makino, Yibang Makino, and Warner Swayze, and Fanuc, a different machine. So you have to reconfigure them. Right? So basically, you have to program, put the blueprint on the table.
Yeah.
You program like a Cutter 201.
And the blueprint is of the part.
It's part.
The blueprint is actually somebody took an isometric drawing.
Yes.
In hand.
Yes.
From a board on a transparency. And that's what you're programming. No CAD.
Then you have to make a circle, say C1, line L1.
Yeah.
So you have a cutter, go left C1, then 2 L1, then turn right, turn left. So this is called APT tool, right?
Amazing.
You build this tool, then make a tape. Then you go to the machine. Load it into the post-processor in the controller. Then you control the cutting tool. But that is numerical control, which is a foundation for today's automation system, right?
Yeah.
So later on, we had the opportunity to work with early years, automotive industry, General Motors. When I worked for Robotics Vision System, RVSI, in Long Island, New York, invested by General Motors to build 3D vision guided robots to make weldings and the sealant, automotive assembly. So the question will be, this was early years of automation. So people have a very vague idea how to do them right. We were challenged by Japanese auto industry, right?
Yeah.
So, hey, auto industry, Detroit was a big three. So, hey, we got to do better in quality, right? Yeah. So we have Demings or whatever, Toyota production system. But that's not just about learning. It's about doing.
Yeah.
How do you make a better quality of tools? Robots, right? And also machine. So, but how to do it? Not just a machine vision, but also feature, like car body when you move.
Yeah.
When they start settle, but they may shift. But you pre-program robot, but if body shift, what do you do? So you have to adjust robot path automatically. That was high tech, 1984. Right? You can adjust the pre-programmed path dynamically, right? Every car. So you can continue the welding without any interruption.
So if you think about yourself back then, you know, there's no internet, there's no cloud, there's no all these kind of things. Like, what are you thinking back then is the, whatever, if this would happen, this is amazing.
Well, see, every generation, we have a different type of a game changer, right?
Yeah.
1960 was the birth of robots. Joe Engelberger, right?
Yeah,
and,
totally.
Unimation. Yep. 70 and the late 60s, 70s, Japanese took it as a major kind of opportunity to build robot, to use robot.
Also, 70s, like PLC is coming for real, like late 70s.
Yeah, because like 1971, 72, the oil crises, right? So Fujitsu had a major change. It's, I got to do some electrical stuff. And that's why Fanuc came about.
Yep.
The Fanuc name called Fujitsu, Automatic Numerical Control, that's what name came from. Fanuc, it was called Fanuc, from there. Right after oil crisis, 1972, right?
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's so interesting.
That's exactly the name came from.
No, the name I knew, but the correlation to the oil crisis and that's
because oil crisis,
them.
Hydraulic system, you want to change to electrical system. That's what it is, right? So what I'm saying that the U.S., we were challenged by the automobile sales in the U.S. So we say we have to make a better car, right? So at that time, the changing a game changer is robots.
Mm-hmm.
And quality was a problem, so we're competing with the Japanese vehicle. Now, how do we solve the problem? Using automation. What's automation? Robots, right?
Yeah.
So robots are a machine, right? So it's a numerical control machine.
Does that mean we kind of also our view is like mostly a decade, like the horizon, you know, like how far we can see with human vision?
Well, in fact, when people thought about robot, right? And one of the big thinking, during the 1980s, we had a lot of people talking about, of course, people worry about job replaced by robots, right? There are also people say, oh, one day they'll become a lights out factory.
Right.
No people.
Yeah.
But that's almost impossible. But people was worried about making a story, right?
Right. Robots taking over the world
exactly.
and taking our jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when you physically do it, you found out it's not just about robots. Yeah. So we had a called Manufacturing Automation Protocol called MAP, MAP.
MAP.
That's yeah. basically called the today's industrial internet.
Yeah.
Right. At that time, we called Manufacturing Automation Protocol, MAP.
Yeah.
Right. So that's today's industrial internet. Exactly the, yeah. the prerequisite, right?
Yeah. This is the amazing part is like, you know, yeah. human problem kind of mapped to time and space. It's like, it's the same problem. They don't really change. Like, we're just trying to optimize them.
Yeah.
Which brings me not exactly to today, but in 2020, you published a book titled Industrial AI Application with Sustainable Performance. And this is predating machine learning. And of course, in the research realm, AI is widely discussed, but like well before all the madness that we're seeing now with generative AI, LLMs and the like, and the maturity. And what's the premise of the book? And what's your perspective 4 years later? So we can like get warmed up into the discussion of the hype cycle and what's the biggest opportunities of this stuff as it comes to industrial applications.
Well, let's first of all talk about motivation, why that book came about.
Yes. And also about the timing, because I think
yes.
it's very interesting, the timing.
Yeah. So during my transition sabbatical with Foxconn, Foxconn's a global manufacturing company, right? So that book started actually 2018, by the way. 2018 was writing the book, and that's based on what we have learned for the last 18 years during the NSF Intelligent Maintenance System Center we've been building using data from different type of machine, how to predict the maintenance, how to predict the failure. So we thought maybe a good time to compile what we have done for the last 18 years before NSF funding is over for total 19 years. That was a planning to make like a kind of a conclusion what we have done for mm-hmm. the 18 years research. But of course, when the opportunity came, I was kind of convinced by Foxconn, say, hey, why don't you help us to build the future global manufacturing program as a vice chairman and board member?
Mm-hmm.
So during that time, I said, well, the biggest challenge is not about technology, AI. It's about talents, okay? How you train the people at a large scale. I'm not talking about training 200 people.
You're talking,
I'm talking about 10,000
people. 100,000
people. 100,000 people.
We need 2, 3 million just in the U.S. alone.
Yes.
And without
yes.
semiconductor, now we need more because
exactly.
CHIP Act is bringing back
yeah.
factories.
Yeah.
We need more.
Yeah. So at that time, we had I call the 3S challenges. First S is a scale. You want to do big scale training.
Yep.
Not one, it's 1,000, 10,000. Second, speed. You cannot just learn AIs like ad hoc. Oh, I learned some basic programming. I take course from the Coursera course. And not one day, 2 days, 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You have to develop AI, test it, implement it in 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We did some example in 1 month.
Scale, speed.
Yeah. And systematically.
Systematically.
Yes. Because traditional AI machine learning is that you and I together, let's say two of us, we have the same data sets, same problem to solve, but we each of us using the same data set, same algorithms, but very often two different results, right?
Yeah.
You say, why? Well, just like a shift, two shift, same kitchen. Same fish, right?
I know the mathematical, computer science answer to that. It involves fuzzy logic, but, it's...
Because the feature selection is different, okay?
Yeah.
But I'm a good chef. When you cook, the way I put the salt, you turn around, you cook things very different.
Yep.
Even I give you same fish to different chef, different taste, right?
Different taste. Yep.
So same thing for AI. So if you do that, it's a big problem because in engineering, we normally call system engineering.
Yep.
If there's a crack in your bearing, in your turbine blades, it's a crack. You cannot say one person say, maybe a crack. Another person say, well, likely the crack. So you got to have a consistent way to draw a decision, right? So I said, well, how can we develop something so I can train engineer with 3S? Speed, scale, and systematically.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole motivation about this book, actually.
So give us an example of what is a great AI application that has sustainable performance that can be mapped and scaled?
Well, for example, we work with Toyota, right? Georgetown, Kentucky plant, where a Camry model was built, right?
Yeah.
2006, we had the opportunity to work with the president of Toyota, Georgetown, Kentucky, which is Mr. Niemi-san.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Niemi was the president. So he said we have some random failure of production, in including compressors. Mm-hmm. There's any way we can remove those failure out, right?
Because it's random.
Exactly. I don't want one year happen January, another year happen February. They randomly happen different time.
Yeah, you can't reproduce only in a car.
Yeah, so can we do that? So we took that as a very great challenge, and we implement a principal component analysis and the support vector machine. And ever since 2006 until last night, no failure.
Mm-hmm.
So for almost 18 years, no failure. Well, there's a no surprise downtime, but there's a maintenance downtime. But I physically schedule you to down for maintenance. That's fine.
But how did the support vector machine catch this in the beginning when it's just ramping up and collecting data? And
well, it's a classification tool, right? How mm-hmm. do you classify the surge? When a machine is a surge, compressor surge happen, the machine just shut down in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. But how do you prevent a surge? By mm-hmm. using the flow sensor, by using the pressure, you can predict and classify potential risk of a surge.
So you created a feedback loop, studied the pattern yes. and the feature, classified, yes. and then created action drivers on that.
Yeah. So what you do is if you detect the likelihood of surge, you can open the inlet guided valve early, yeah. relieve the pressure. So yeah. the machine never have a certain failure, right?
That's a great story. Now, can you imagine implementing what you did in 06 with what you have today, cloud, industrial IoT, Gen AI? Now, go back to that point and like, how long did it take you?
Well, that project took us 6 months, right?
Uh-huh.
We had the mistakes first. We located wrong problems. But later on, we have a number of other projects, sometimes 3 months, sometimes 1 month. So eventually, my question will be, if the problem need to be similar problems, mm-hmm. I don't need 6 months. No. I can finish it in 3 weeks, 3 days. How about 3 hours, right? One day, right?
Yeah, so that's my question. If the same yeah. problem from 06 to today, you know, so it's like yes. proportion of almost like 20 years, right?
Yeah.
How long would it take today? We
days.
Just got days. You're saying we're in days. So days, we moved from months
to days. We'll be able to finish in 2 to 3 days, yes.
Okay.
Which we already demonstrate some of the problems we did this last year. Did it in 2.5 days for the special project of a space shuttle that from Japan NASA.
Mm-hmm.
They can detect the likelihood of valve failure. That was the data challenge project we did. So students spent 2.5 days and 100% correct, yeah.
So now is a good introspection to the premise of the book and the impact and the great example, and we see the progression from technology side. But let's talk about the human aspect for a second. And you know, this is sort of where I'm very passionate about, and this idea that lean needs to be augmented, hence augmented lean, and the approach that, you know, you have to... I'll tell you this, like from my, call it like professional paranoia, okay? I kind of feel that in the traditional sense, digital transformation as we knew it, you know, the 25 years or so of PC revolution, you know, large scale office suites, cloud, you know, everything that drives our businesses, forget operation for a second. If that kind of skipped over the people in the factory line that were still filling up, you know, Kanban cards yeah. and whiteboards, we used to call that industry 4.0 for a decade. Now, I think less so, because it's kind of done in a way. We can circle back on that. But my point is, if the same operation people, you know, I'm speaking about the associates building stuff, the engineering kind of stuff, are not getting access to this AI stuff, Gen AI and deep learning and whatever, then we're missing something here. How do we make sure that the people are stay there and involved? Let's discuss this a little bit.
Sure. Well, AI, right, to me, augmented intelligence is the basic stuff. Forget about artificial intelligence. First should be augmented yeah. intelligence, right?
Yeah, that's what my PhD advisor, Patti Maas, she always yes. used to say, don't think about AI, think about IA, which is intelligence augmentation, you know?
Yes, yeah. So from augmented intelligence, which means how do you help the people to do things they could not do,
right.
or they may not be able to see the problems. So I call it visible and invisible. Human being, we grew our knowledge based on the physical, evident experience.
Yep.
Like we made mistakes.
What the senses can sense.
You got burnt, you remember, right?
Yep. Yep.
But how about those things you have not encountered? Sometimes we see the problem, we didn't even know why. So I think the one thing that, because AI is a data-centric system, you have data to drive that. Of course, there's also physics-informed AI. You can integrate data in the model. But again, the purpose to help people to see things you don't see. For example, wind turbine, you have ice accumulate on the blades. So, your power generation dropped. But why? Because in the mountain, you got a low temperature in the night. you got high humidity. Ah, that's why you got ice accumulated blades. That's why you are losing energy, power generation. Turbine designer, they didn't know that one, right? Because wind farm owner can be owned anywhere, right? Can be a mountain, can be offshore, can be along the highway, right? So eventually what I'm saying, the AI is a good way to augment what human being cannot do or don't do well.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, one day AI can help with autonomous intelligence that somehow you don't want everything, you have to like repeating work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, human being have to repeat same kind of work, right?
Yep.
But if you can use that, AI can autonomously repeat that work. So remove your worry out, right? We call worry reduction. That would be the best. But not to replace people alone.
Yeah.
Basically, you reduce redundant work is what it is. Yep. Okay?
But we kind of touched on this, and I think sometimes people are like almost afraid of talking about this, you know, the geopolitics of the global supply chain, you know? It's like we're seeing the tensions between, you know, China and the U.S., we're seeing the global supply chain dependency, right? And people are speaking about reshoring. And still, we live in this global economy. You know, the US is missing 2-3 million. Europe is missing 2-3 million. I don't know what's your view on China. It depends on like how you think about their evolution, but obviously a huge economy. What's your take on all that as it comes to like the role of AI? You mentioned before the robots have not taken over, in fact. Yeah. You know, we still need the humans, and like, how are we going to deal with this problem globally that we don't have enough people in operation given AI?
Well, if you look back, right, 20 years ago, we have offshore, right? Offshore, people start globalizing many things, right?
Right.
That's why in 2000, China had a great opportunity to outsourcing to do lots of contract manufacturing. That's how it started, right?
Right.
But over years, even like semiconductor, like a fabless,
right?
Right. If Intel even went to fabless and many companies to fabless. So eventually that's how Korea and Taiwan start making chips. But after 20 some years, they become a giant, right?
Right.
So not one day transformation.
Not one day.
Many, many years, right? Now we say 20 years later, we say, oh, we want to do more. Well, there are some numbers. US, we have about 150 million workforce, but only about 15 million worker in manufacturing.
Yeah.
But we could have more. But depends on what type of work you want more.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a lot of low-skilled workforce, it is what you want, or you want to increase the GDP per capita.
Okay.
We're now $80,000
I think we want
year.
Option number two.
Yes.
How do we do that?
I want to see our GDP per capita is $100,000, not $80,000, okay? Mm-hmm. Singapore, Switzerland today is exceed $100,000, right?
Yep.
So if that's the case, so oh, what can I do to improve my efficiency and productivity? That's the purpose, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Not focus on replace people. That's not the problem. The problem is productivity, competitive position. That's what we want.
Yep.
So if that's the case, every country is a problem. Every country. You know? China had a great growth for the last 20 years. Then because they leapfrogged many, many stages.
Yep.
Now, certainly, you have a geopolitical constraint. Now, you have to re-examine what needs to be redone. So that's why if you look at Global Lighthouse Network, there are so many companies trying to do Lighthouse. Why? The two reasons. Number one, the baseline they came from was okay, but not good enough, right? So baseline was much lower, so they can easily improve 2x, sometimes 3x efficiency,
yeah.
Right?
You know, we're both on the same sort of Lighthouse expert group. I should have checked that, but I think we've crossed already 50 out of...
153 now.
Yeah, but more than 50 are in China.
Oh, yeah. China has over 50. Yeah, almost 60 now.
And
yes,
this is sort of the point I'm driving. It's like you mentioned, you know, 20 years is a long time and started small and outsourcing and contract manufacturing. But then it becomes, you know, I say from contract manufacturing to core competency.
Yeah.
And when the core competency shifts from one place to another geographically, then you have a deficit where it moved from.
Well, it's about ecosystem, right? Just like Detroit used to be, had a strong ecosystem back in 1970s, 80s, right? Mm-hmm. So almost every company in Detroit, they are really, truly dovetailed together. They are so integrated, they can make almost anything, right?
Right.
Of course, and for the last 20 years, you see other part of the world, they're doing similar things. So that's why you can see EV production, a very good supply chain. But we have to ask ourselves, what can we do to select the right area to increase our productivity, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do everything, that's not necessary because you're probably going to run out energy to do everything.
Yeah.
So for example, electronic manufacturing, we want a high-end AI chips. You want to do HGPUs. future server, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you want to make those high-end, we call high value, sometimes may not be high value, okay? But I call high value system, satellite system, right? But you want a high value system, the reason is we don't have a high volume workforce, but we want to create a high value workforce using machine learning as a good productivity tool.
Okay, this is important. So this is the transition from high volume to high value.
Yes.
But geopolitical tensions aside, I'm still an optimist and believe in the human race in general. Maybe I'm too naive. But you brought together with Foxconn, I'd say, operations to the US and research to the US. So we're seeing such a major company like Foxconn coming here and setting up. Can you share a little bit about that? And like, what was the genesis of the AI division for Foxconn? And what's the goal and how are you playing in this ecosystem?
Yeah, Foxconn had early establishments in US back in the 1980s, right?
Yeah.
So there, so far, it's about 16 locations in the United States, I would say probably even more now. Wisconsin was the most recent one, because of the one I physically was involved was responsible because of the early stage of the year to look for the new potential opportunity to build manufacturing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So later on, we changed to a new area to make a high-end, high-performance computing devices, right? So because it's high-end and it's a high value, it's using a lot of automation, right? SMT, which is a fundamental platform for Foxconn to make a high-volume production. And if you see what's happening right now with all the GPU going on worldwide with A100, H100, and Foxconn also play a big role in here making GPUs, right? So Wisconsin has a great foundation to make a strong and very high-value electronic system there. So to me, that's a new addition. But sometimes you have to redesign the production because it may not work for all areas. We have to, I'm sure you have to redesign the system so you have a more integrated automation system, not fragmented automation system.
Mm-hmm.
And second thing, we have to start looking at the suppliers that US has a very strong presence in domestically. We can support that. Even we have a new design and to educate a new workforce, right? For example, we do an assembly system. We adopt a lot of high-speed AOI, machine vision. That's where we build industrial AI there because we have lots of data. We create a scheme called stream of quality, SOQ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so traditionally, inspections each individual station, only inspect one area.
Yep.
Now we connect the quality data stream like a river.
Yeah.
So you connect the river, I mean, you have to connect data flow together. So
yeah.
The AI have to work as a stream, not with individual station. So a new skill sets that most industry, I would say most companies didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Even today, I don't think they have it. But of course, we were leading that.
Yeah. So this leads us to all this development. And if we think about the future, so, you know, when I think about the future, I think that if we miss the education piece of this, and this is going full circle to, you know, you talked about the cycles you went through and back to academia to focus deeply.
Yes.
If we think about the future, what's the role of education here? What do we need to do as it comes to making sure that the next generation is ready, given all the transformation that we've seen?
Well, we have to think this way, right? So I often use a 3T to conclude. One's technology, one's the tools, one's the talents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Technology continue evolving, but we need to have a tool to have a systematic way to do things, what technology bring about. Then we need a talent can use a tool to do that every day, right? So the 3T are connected. So one of the big thing I believe right now, the industry, most companies say, well, how can I use the data? I have a lot of data. I don't know how to select the right data for machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
I want to learn AI, but how do I implement AI?
So what do we do? Like what do university programs need to evolve into? Like what's the curricula need to evolve into?
Well, that's exactly what we created called the Industrial AI Curriculum at the University of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are creating a Master of Engineering in Industrial AI program.
Okay.
So with a 4P system, right? Principle-based learning, you learn courses, basic stuff. You can learn by yourself or we teach you a fundamental one first. Second one is the most important called practice-based approach.
Mm-hmm.
So we use real data from industry we've been accumulating over the years.
I see.
We give a data set to students, hey, take the data sets, use the tool you learn, solve the problem. Because we had the previously solved the problem, so we have the baseline to compare benchmark. The third, project-based. Hey, you have to go to find your own data sets
Right, in a real manufacturing environment.
In a real manufacturing environment.
Yeah, perfect.
Or from the open source.
Right.
But that has to be usable, not just useful. The fourth one is be professional based. You have to be able to be like a mass black belt. You can teach other people to do 1, 2, 3, right?
I see.
So called 4P, principle based, practice based, project based, and professional based.
Amazing.
So this 4P approach to give us a very good edge to develop a program to train 10,000 engineers. This is our goal, train 10,000 engineers in 10 years.
So we're going to include those links to the program. It's online, right? We can include?
Partial information is online, but I think we're releasing soon, yes.
Okay, whatever you can send us, we would love to share it. We're contributing to this ecosystem. And you know, this is what I think this conversation is really about. And we talked about the 3S, the 3T, and now the 4Ps. Yeah. And we'll send a quiz like to, you know, after this. Professor Lee gives you an A plus or not, we'll see. But certainly this has been fascinating and I've learned a lot. It's always great to get together and really enjoy our conversation. We will do this again.
Anytime, yeah.
I really appreciated you coming on the show and thank you so much, Lee.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Perfect. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Augmented Ops Podcast from Tulip Interfaces. We hope you found this week's episode informative and inspiring. You can find the show on LinkedIn and YouTube or at tulip.co/podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time.